Hello, and welcome to episode 18 of The Winning Agenda. Tonight, our panelists include local judge, tournament organiser, and contributor to the Australian Tabletop Gaming Network, Thomas Daniel.
Hey, guys.
Runner-up for both the 2014 Melbourne Regionals and the 2014 Australian Nationals, Liam Prasad.
Hey, yo, what's up?
Two-time store champion and three-time Magic the Gathering Pro Tour competitor, Wilfie Horrig.
Hi, everyone.
2014 Australian National Champion and 2014 World's Top 16 competitor, Jesse Marshall.
Hi there.
And I'm Brian Holland, 2014 Australian Nationals Top 8 competitor. We're going to start the episode off tonight with our final meta strategy segment, and today's segment is on aggro decks. So, Jesse, what is an aggressive deck when compared to a control or a mid-range deck, which we've talked about in the past 2 weeks?
An aggressive deck is a deck that gives itself the capability of scoring or stealing agendas early, and therefore the capability of wrapping the game up quickly. In doing so, deprives itself of the ability to compete in the long game. So if you are piloting an aggressive deck and you don't score early and you don't use your cards that allow you to score early, such as Biotic Labor or Sansan City Grid are great examples of aggressive corp cards. If you don't use those and you just let them sit in your hand and then you try and use those cards in the late game, it won't work because your deck will be designed to have small ice that will keep the runner out early, but once the runner has breakers will turn off. That's often known as binary ice, so ice that will have an end the run subroutine such as Quandary, which is very low cost to res, keeps the runner out early, but as soon as they have a breaker is almost useless. So if you try and sit behind those sorts of ice, Quandary, pop-up window, paper wall, ice wall, if you sit behind those sorts of ice and expect that they're going to keep the runner out in the late game, you're not going to win because the runner is going to be able to get through those ice very efficiently once they have a rig set up. So what you're aiming to do is exploit the time when the runner doesn't have a rig set up, when they haven't got many breakers in play, and you're trying to stretch their actions on their turn, forcing them to make runs that aren't very efficient just to either check what you have in a remote server or check what ice you have on your centrals. And use that time when their resources are most stretched by having to do that to score agendas, and playing cards in your deck like the small binary ice that allow you to invest very little for a very impactful effect at the start of the game, to leverage those cards and event economy cards that give you a temporary but large boost in economy to be able to score agendas very quickly. So that's an aggressive corp strategy. An aggressive runner might be looking to put as much pressure as possible in those early turns to build up its economy very quickly, to try and attack centrals very recklessly, and not play cards that are going to set it up for the long game and try and keep the corp off resources for as long as possible. So an aggressive deck, if you want to look at it as a sort of curve, they're trying to use most of their impactful cards at the very beginning of the game, keep their opponent's resources very stretched, and force their opponent to use resources in a way that they wouldn't necessarily do if they had the choice, to try and stop their opponent from doing what they want to be doing, but also make their opponent unable to interact very meaningfully in the early phase of the game when the aggressive deck is at its best. So that's the essence of an aggressive strategy.
Jesse, just one thing. You did mention that an aggressive runner is ideally trying to steal agendas quickly and efficiently in the early game. Would you say that strategy is somewhat nullified by, say, a glacial control deck, which has very minimal agendas?
It definitely makes it more difficult. There are ways that you can try to get around that as a runner. You can play things like Demolition Run, which let you get through more of the deck, or you could play the new card Showing Off, which lets you see the bottom cards of the deck, just so that you're getting more exposure to more cards more quickly, rather than allowing the corporation to control essentially how many cards off R&D you're seeing just based on their natural draw. Because one of the risks certainly is, as an aggressive runner, that if you're playing against a Glacier deck, which is minimizing its agenda density as much as possible, that the agendas just might not be in the cards that are on the top 4 or 5 cards of R&D and in the corp's starting hand. And if that's the case, and you're unable to find any agendas in the first few turns, then you could put yourself on the back foot and give the corp the ability to, or you don't put yourself on the back foot, you could just be put on the back foot by that occurrence. And what that can do is give the corp the ability to stabilize and get themselves into a position where their resources aren't stretched, and they've in fact developed their board to an extent that they're doing things quite efficiently and being able to keep you out. So that's one of the reasons why aggressive runner strategies are a lot more difficult, to use in the current metagame is that agenda density it can be quite low in decks like Replicating Perfection and other control decks, and that can just be a death knell for a lot of aggressive runners. The other reason is that you can, if you are too aggressive as a runner, there is a much higher risk than as the corporation, in the sense that you're opening yourself up to the other win condition for corporations being flatline, unless you're able to completely deprive the corporation of their credit resources as well.
Just on that note, I think there is an alternate approach that aggressive decks can take there, not necessarily just trying to gain accesses to score agendas, but keeping an approach that keeps the corp in the early game for as long as possible in order for that natural draw step to bring agendas into the game where they can then be stolen during the early to mid game. Another aggressive strategy, I think there's a great example in a deck we talked about in our deck tech special that was sent in by one of the listeners, the Spanish Influenza, that plays Gabriel Santiago with Sneak Door and Lamprey to keep the corp's credits down. And just in some of the games I've played with Wilfie, where he's been attacking me very aggressively with his Gabriel Santiago Lamprey deck, the credits that you just hemorrhage as the corp keep you on the back foot constantly. And even though you do go the turn 10 or turn 12 sometimes, because you can never really get back on your feet economically, when Gabriel does just start to try and score those agendas, once they've all just been drawn off the top of the deck naturally, he has that capacity to, by keeping you in the early game for as long as possible. I think that's a very different approach, but I think that's quite aggressive as well.
Is there a couple of examples of current archetypes which are aggressive decks on both the corp and runner side?
I think fast advanced decks on the corp side are the epitome of an aggressive deck, because as the corporation, if you're trying to be aggressive, then you're trying to end the game as quickly as possible, and fast advance is really the only way that you can be aggressive with scoring because of the cost to the corp of setting up a remote server whilst protecting centrals. So, using fast advance allows you to negate the risk of losing your agendas out of the remote, even if you're setting up a lightly iced remote for a sand sand or something like that. That's often just about taxing the runner. So fast advance is one of the only ways that the corp can really be aggressive in terms of scoring.
What about Wilfie's PE list?
Yeah, in terms of scoring, fast advance is really the only way the corp can do it. But if they want to try and threaten to flatline the runner as well, then they can rely on that threat to either kill the runner early if the runner tries to engage in that early game phase with the corp servers, or they can just use that threat to score out agendas. So the personal evolution deck that Wilfie's been piloting recently, that's a bit different to the Cambridge list in that it doesn't try and whittle down the runner's resources over the long game, but rather tries to present the runner with some credible threats of flatline early and also some beefier agendas, most of which are 2 or 3 points, allowing it to try and force through impactful large point value agendas early by using the threat of things like Psychic Field and Neural EMP and Ronin to keep the runner questioning whether they want to run. So that's another option for an aggressive corp deck.
If it isn't clear to absolutely everyone yet, Wilfie is very much our resident red mage. He loves to go fast.
Yeah.
It is great. And I just want to say quickly that the one thing that ties these type of strategies together is pressuring your opponent early, like making them react to what you're doing and trying to snowball it from there. So just the strategy of being able to attack your opponent's resources, whether it be time or credits, and through that force them to disrupt their game plan to react to you, which is not what the corp wants, which is not what your opponent wants to do. They want to progress their game plan.
I think Noise has often been an aggressive runner deck in that it can threaten all three of the corp's central servers early. You can, if you're playing viruses as well as the multi-access viruses, being Medium and Nerve Agent, you can threaten to access multiple cards from R&D and HQ, meanwhile milling random cards from R&D, so therefore getting essentially random accesses from R&D at the same time. So that Noise deck, it really forces the runner to be icing up all three of their centrals in the early game, which is not something a lot of... Sorry, forces the corp to be icing up all three of their centrals in the early game, which is not something a lot of corps want to do, and really tries to stretch their resources as thinly as possible and use efficient breakers such as Knight, which are efficient at gaining access early, but not necessarily efficient in the long game once the corp has multiple ice on each server. So using cards like Knight to be able to get into HQ and R&D, leverage those cards like Medium and Nerve Agent for multiple accesses, all the while threatening milling constantly cards into archives from the top of R&D. That sort of deck is exactly about riding the wave, stretching the opponent's resources, and trying to win as quickly as possible before they have a chance to get back on their feet and set up defenses that you can't get through as efficiently.
When I think of noise, I think of the people who are like, well, I'm going to mulligan to Wildside, sit there for like 16 turns, and then you're going to mill.
So the sort of noise deck that I'm referring to there is one that is going to play Datasucker, Corroder, Mimic, Yogg, Parasite, Medium, Nerve Agent, some sort of economy cards that are going to allow it to play those, be it Shaw Gamble, Dirty Laundry, Daily Casts, and then play some breakers such as Knight or potentially Crypsis that are going to allow it to really reliably land the blows from the Nerve Agent and the Medium, or to gain access to archives at an opportune moment when it needs to. So it's not a deck that's tinkering around with heaps of hardware or heaps and heaps of viruses, but it's a deck that's going to be trying to play out as many cards as it can early on in the game and keep the pressure on the corp from probably turn 2 to turn 8 or 9, and it hopefully longer if you can keep their resources down and keep gaining access reliably turn after turn.
And I think very early in the game in Season 1 or 2, we saw a lot of noise lists like that, just like Jesse explained in that very specific build, often playing account siphon as well. And I think a very strong aggressive strategy in the runner right now that's analogous to that effect of Knight in noise is actually Riel Peddler's ability to make a piece of art into a code gate with a code gate breaker and maybe playing siphon in there as well. The ability to always guarantee access to the centrals on those first and second and third turns is the crux of an aggro deck. And if your identity or if your breaker suite can't necessarily give you that, you're probably playing a different archetype.
Excellent. Next, we're just going to move on to a deck tech on Nirith Hub aggro. So I've been playing this list for quite a while, and during the time, it's gone through quite a few iterations, mainly just to adapt to the current meta. And most recently, the changes have been to the ice. As with most aggressive decks, as discussed, your early game is very good, and you want to res cheap ice that keeps the runner out and force them to go and get a breaker. What I was finding, however, when using just paper walls and Eli's, the servers didn't become as taxing as they needed to be in the mid game. I've begun playing Marcus and Walls of Static in those that paper wall slot, and while these ice are marginally more expensive to res, resulting in the deck being mildly slower, I found the time it can take you, both in the terms of the runner fetching a breaker and the runner accumulating resources to consistently break the ice, is worth it. Marcus is especially good because he punishes face checking in a way that Eli cannot. Similarly, I played Architect for a while. It was really better at punishing bad play from your opponent. Most good players were aware of cards like Rotor Turret and Architect and didn't run until they have a Sentry Breaker, and that turned Architect into like a 2-cost ice for the runner to get through, and it really wasn't good enough. So instead, I've begun to play Errand Boy in the Sentry slot, and it's been really fantastic. Having those three subroutines that both give you an option of which resource you wish to gain, or instead just plainly costing the runner 3 credits to get through, is really fantastic. When playing the deck, ideally, you want to spend the first couple of turns protecting your centrals and creating a remote server. In most of my games, I want to be scoring a 3-for-2 on turn 2 or 3. People say that they say it's not an interactive deck, but that's not true. I think it's interactive in the most core aspect of Netrunner, and one of the aspects we discuss often on this show, and that is forcing the runner to play their cards. You want to install a Quandary and Eli and Errand Boy and force the runner to go and assemble that rig while you're busy resing Sansans and scoring agendas. You want to install out that pop-up window to force the inside jobs for little to no value. The worst place this deck can get to, however, is, I think, two different situations. So the first is to be hit with multiple siphons, so keeping you off money, especially after you've got that Sansan rezzed or that first Astro Counter online, is very important. The other way the runner can keep you off money is by consistently threatening multiple servers and forcing you to rez more ice than you normally would have liked, such as if your opponent's playing noise, you do really need to protect archives. Normally you just wouldn't even bother with it, in my opinion. Pad campaigns can help with this, and taxing enough to trash for the runner that it gives you some time to build back your resources after they do that. The other way is they can lock you out of R&D. With some dedicated shaper decks, this can occur in the mid game, which is earlier than it normally would against most decks. And if the runner is hitting R&D for even only 2 cards or maybe 3 cards per turn and trashing your Jacksons, you're really in a bad spot. And the only thing you can hope for is to get a fast track to get you out of those, get out those last agendas. Liam, you played this deck recently in the league. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think we're playing slightly different builds. Whereas your build had the Wall of Savics and the Marxes, my build was, I kind of pushed it in the other direction. So whereas back in regionals, our lists were basically 49 of the same cards. At this point, you know, we have a little bit of a different play style. So you've gone for a slightly more longer strategy where the runner is interacting with you more, whereas I've gone the opposite direction for a much more aggressive strategy where the runner is interacting with me less. And, you know, it's just the same. They're different responses to the same problem we've both been experiencing. And that problem, I think, is that runners have adapted to NEH being in the format. We are seeing a lot more cheap breakers. We are seeing a lot more breakers in our decks. Gone are the days when Andromeda will safely play one of each breaker and maybe a second Kurotha just in case, you know. It's very common now to see sometimes even two Passports and a Yogg, or sometimes an Inti and a Snowball in your Shaper deck, as well as a Gorthion Blade, as well as a Zoo Keymaster. So the runner decks are getting a lot of flexibility in the way they start assembling these breakers and making runs, which is why I was very tentative to include something like Wall of Static, because whilst it demands the breaker in the same way that Paper Wall does, because the runners have so much cheap ice, because the runners have so many cheap breakers, and one axis is usually enough for them to start combating you, that first access is what really put me off. You know, so the difference between a Gorthion Blade and a Zoo is the difference in cost that they would need to make that run through an Enigma, and that one is usually enough. So I've gone in the other direction. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right about these weaknesses. The fact that R&D interface and Maker's Eyes effects and legwork effects are so strong against the deck. The deck is cold to simply being accessed from. None of your agendas protect themselves unless you're playing NAPD contracts. But on top of that, none of your servers are particularly taxing, so NAPD contracts never really approach it. Their credits never really approach that critical low point where NAPD contracts can afford to not be stolen. So siphons are particularly good there, not just because they take your money down, but because they swing the runner's economy back up. And again, just let them consistently attack without necessarily going down. It's tough enough to tax them already. So there are a few ways to combat that. We've been playing these shipments from Sansan, and we've been rezzing our Sansans in response. I think Pad Campaign is a really great response there to the siphons. Pad Campaign has been
very good.
Pad Campaign has been very good for you, hey?
Yeah, I was very reluctant to add it into the deck because I've always been of the opinion that most decks are playing things like marked accounts and pad campaigns and other asset economies just to, you know, play them down in order to draw that extra card. Whereas my opinion has always been if the card that you had to play in the remote server was just the card that you wanted to draw in the first place, then you wouldn't need it. But pad campaign, I still don't think I would play marked accounts. I think it's too slow and I don't think there's the deck space for it. But pad campaign is good because the runner can siphon you, and then in some situations you're still going to have 3 credits at the start of your next turn, and forcing the runner to go and trash those for 4 credits or sometimes 3 if they've got Desperado is still pretty good.
And I think a pad campaign is particularly good in your slightly more taxing variant, just because it does cost 4. If the runner ever chooses to trash that, that's an NAPD they're not stealing. That's an access they're no longer making. Or that's a run they can no longer make. So whereas it's not very good in my variant at all, which is very, very aggressive, it's actually phenomenal in yours, just because the ice is that little bit more taxing, and it is very much about that critical mass.
Lastly for today, we're just going to pass it over to Judge Tom Daniel to do a little bit of a Tournament Organisation 101 segment. So Tom's been running events here in Melbourne for longer than I've known him, so I'm sure he's got plenty of information to share, little tips and tricks that if you're looking to get into running tournaments and how to run your tournaments smoothly. I know it's a very sort of daunting task for some people. Like, I haven't attempted it myself because it seems like a very sort of stressful and situation to be in. So Tom, what do you have to say, tell about us on that subject?
Sure, thanks. So I think the first thing, and probably the most important thing to do when you're thinking of running an event, is just all the preparation, thinking about not only the big things but the small things that are going to happen. And to start on a basic level, I mean, if I look back to CanCon, you know, the first thing is, well, I'm not going to have access to a computer, which means I'm not going to be able to use tournament software, which means I have to do everything by hand. So because of that, you know, I did my did my homework, you know, looked at the way that breakers work and things like that. And I tried to figure out in my head, well, what's the most efficient way for me to do things by hand? And also preemptively realized that in, I guess, the best benefit of players, reducing the round times to 60 minutes as opposed to the standard 65 minutes, just to give me that extra time to do all the pairings and make sure, you know, people aren't there for the extra half hour, 40 minutes that, you know, they don't really need to be. So that's kind of the main thing. So we've got the preparation in terms of software and things like that, but being mentally prepared is also a pretty big deal. I know if someone asked me to run an event like tomorrow, just on a whim, I'd probably be a bit unprepared.
How do you go about, especially in the LCGs, as opposed to something like Magic the Gathering, which has a very stringent, thick infraction procedure guide and a judge program, how do you go about taking judge calls and deciding you know, what infractions to enforce when something has gone wrong in a Netrunner tournament?
Sure. So I guess for those who don't know, I'm also a Magic the Gathering judge. Liam's also a L1 as well. Magic has, as you say, Brian, a very strict infraction procedure guide that essentially tells you everything. It will resolve any situation on its own. If you fed it into some kind of robot, it would work. So a lot of, you know, before we have this judge program, a lot of what we do is kind of getting the next best thing, like trying to apply a lot of that stuff into Netrunner. Obviously, the first thing you want to do is decide, well, how competitive is this tournament? You know, if someone's, you know, forgotten to take their Desperado credit and you're playing at a game night, you know, let them have it. Like, it's not that big a deal. If they forgot it three turns ago, then, well, maybe tell them to be a bit more careful. But, you know, being casual at casual events is perfectly fine. When we go to, like, a national level or a regional level tournament, that's where things need to be enforced more strictly. You know, players need to be held accountable and held to the level of the tournament that they're playing at. So if we have an example like that, missing the Desperado trigger, we could say, you know, if this was at, you know, a nationals or anything like that, essentially, if they've done anything between when they would have had to take the credit, oftentimes it's, well, would your opponent like you to gain that credit? You know, is your opponent going to be the nice guy, or it, you know, are they going to not? I guess the philosophy behind that means that, you know, your opponent's never going to feel bad, right? And you'll feel bad, but it is your own fault.
Fantasy Flight is very good with supporting their TOs and event organizers. So for those of you who don't know, some of the things like the Store Champs kit do actually come with an extra playmat, which is absent of the Store Championship or the event title on it, which is meant to go to the TO. So I'm sure there are some people out there, some of the listeners, who might want to be getting into tournament organizing or judging an event, not just to get those extra prizes, but also to, you know, be a part of and support the community. So how would you advise they go about trying to get into that, Tom?
Yeah, so the best thing you can do is talk to your local game store. Being completely honest, a lot of stores, their priorities lie in where they get their money from. So for most places, that's Magic the Gathering, could be Yu-Gi-Oh!, could be Pokemon or something like that. And because LCGs are, you know, we've said before, a more consumer-focused product, a lot of them don't spend a lot of time to learn the tournament rules and things like that. So, I mean, I've worked at a couple of gaming stores and I talked to a lot of other ones, and most of them are very happy to have someone kind of take the reins and ensure that they're going to have a fantastic tournament. I mean, the amount of times we've been to an event, like a game night or something like that, and the person behind the counter doesn't really know what's going on, and, you know, it means you're waiting 15 minutes between rounds, it absolutely sucks. So, you know, you're ensuring that they have a high quality event, and you need to let them know that. You know, just ask them, like, oh, whether you want to do it for free because you're just a nice guy, or whether you hold yourself to a more professional standard and, you know, you feel like you should be compensated more, that's a conversation that you can have. And the great thing about Magic and judges is that that's a conversation that many stores do have. They will run like a Grand Prix trial or a pre-pro tour qualifier, and they'll have to get judges, and they'll reward them with things like store credit or other types of things. Since about 2013, I think 2013 regionals, they started to include this type of stuff. So, look, they're definitely taking steps forward now with the upcoming judge program that, you know, hopefully in a year or two's time, you know, the way that we'll be talking about organized play will just be a much higher standard. So the most common thing that would happen that is something that I would punish with something like a game loss would be a deck error. And this is obviously at a regional or a national level. You know, all of these tournaments require you to bring a deck list. They require it for a reason. And that's so you can't be changing cards in between rounds and things like that. When you get to this, it's kind of twofold, right? Like, you'll have some people who, you know, put down that they're running 3 Elis and 2 Marcuses, but they're actually running 3 Marcuses and 2 Elis or whatever. And that's, whilst it's still an error that you do have to punish, it's quite tough because it's obviously a pretty simple problem, right? Like, it's very feel bad for the player. On the other side, you have errors that are like, oh, this person forgot to put... You know, this person only has 16 agenda points in their deck that's supposed to have 20, which is something that they gain a massive advantage out of, which is obviously a lot easier to explain to them, but kind of just as bad. Like, it's still punished with the same thing. So that's the most common thing that happens that you'll have to kind of have a conversation with a player about. The other common things are just like, judge, I forgot to name a thing with my security testing, or judge, I don't understand how this interaction works. And most of those things are just like, oh, well, it's in the FAQ, here is how it works. Every event that I've run, be it Magic or be it Netrunner, every event that's gone beyond 4 rounds and I do deck checks, there has always been one person who has had had an error. So, like, don't be that person, I guess.
That's about all we have time for this week. As usual, you can check us out on Twitter at Winning Agenda. Check us out on Facebook. Our like page is The Winning Agenda. You can send us a question or topic, or if you just want to get in touch with us, you can shoot us an email at thewinningagenda@gmail.com. And until then, we'll be back each and every Monday going forward, and we look forward to hearing from all of you. So thanks, guys. See you soon.
Cheers.
Triple check your deck lists.
Triple check your deck lists. Yeah.